Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. This is episode 2.32, The Three Pashas. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. So I have some good news. Even though I have been away for a bit, I promise I have not been idle. In fact, I've been hard at work on something new, and today I'm excited to tell you more about it. Now, I mentioned this briefly a couple episodes back, but I have now completed the first season of a brand new podcast I'll be launching later this year called Ism. And if you've enjoyed this show, I think you're going to love it, because at its heart, Ism explores a pretty familiar question for us here. What happens when ideas meet the realities of power? Season 1 of Ism traces the origins of socialism in the 19th century. But rather than keeping ideas abstract, we ground the story in specific places and moments. So we'll follow socialism's first generation through the revolutionary upheavals of Paris, 1793, 1848, 1871, where the earliest currents of socialism and anarchism were first put to the test. And then in between, we'll explore the ideas behind these events through conceptual episodes that ask straightforward questions like, what is socialism, what is Jacobinism, and Marxism versus anarchism? And then within these episodes, I've been working on a new format, blending the kind of historical analysis we do here, but interspersed with short immersive narrative scenes told from the perspectives of the figures who lived these ideas. So like snippets of a novel following people like Louis Michel, Victor Hugo, Rosa Luxemburg, George Orwell, Emma Goldman, and eventually Marx and Lenin themselves. So there's a lot to look forward to, and I want you there with me. If you've been here through 20th Century Revolutions, then Ism is the next step of this journey. And as a special thank you to everyone who has followed 20th Century Revolutions thus far, I'm releasing a bonus Ism-style episode right here on this feed. So after today's Season 2 finale, keep an eye out for that episode, which will be set in Sarajevo, 1914, as the teenager Gavrilo Princip steps out of a crowd, fires his pistol at the heir to the Austrian throne, and changes the course of world history forever. That bonus episode will drop at the same time that the first three episodes of Ism drop. So when you see Sarajevo appear, that means Ism is live. But for today, we do need to close out this second season, the story of the Young Turk Revolution and its aftermath amidst the ongoing collapse of the Ottoman Empire. So we will begin with a quick catch-up on where we've been, focusing on the larger significance of the crises of 1912 to 13. Then we'll trace the rise of the CUP dictatorship under the so-called Three Pashas, Talat, Enver, and Jemal, though, as we'll discuss, the triumvirate label has been challenged recently with growing evidence that Talat was very much first among equals. And finally, we'll walk through the decisions that brought the Ottomans into the First World War, the conflict that would, at long last, bring an end to the 600-year-old empire. So, let's get into it. Last time, we left off in the dramatic year of 1913, a year whose events would, in many ways, set the course for the final decade of the Ottoman Empire's existence. As the catastrophe of the First Balkan War was unfolding, a core group of CUP conspirators led by Ismail Enver and Mehmed Talat seized their moment to take power. In January, they launched what would become known as the Raid on the Sublime Porte. With characteristic theatrical flair, Enver led a detachment of hardened Unionist officers to storm the government headquarters. In the chaos that followed, War Minister Nazim Pasha was shot and killed, and then Enver forced the Grand Vizier, Kamil Pasha, to resign at gunpoint. Meanwhile, Talat, ever the energetic organizer behind the scenes, moved quickly to establish control of the government ministries. He sent telegraphs all across the empire, contacting both government administrators and CUP agents. Talat's message was that the Unionist Patriots had been left with no choice. The government in Istanbul, they said, was preparing to surrender Edirne, a city just a short march from the capital in Istanbul and the beloved hometown of Talat himself. To let Edirne fall would have been an unforgivable humiliation. In the weeks and months that followed the raid on the Sublime Port, the CUP moved quickly to crush what remained of the opposition. But Talat, Enver, and Jemal, the three pashas who give this episode its name, still avoided openly taking the reins of government. Ever since the Young Turk Revolution of 1908, the Committee of Union and Progress, the CUP, had always preferred to rule from the shadows, acting as vigilant overseers rather than sitting ministers. The raid was now the third time they had intervened directly to reshape the government, and yet their most powerful leaders still declined to claim dictatorial authority outright. Instead, they once again installed General Mahmud Shevket Pasha at the top of the state. Shevket emerged from the crisis as a de facto dictator, simultaneously grand vizier, war minister, foreign minister, and field marshal. And while Shevket handled the public responsibilities of power, Talat strengthened his position inside the CUP, and within weeks he was recognized as the organization's true master. Enver may have been the swashbuckling hero of the raid, but it was Talat who had orchestrated the whole affair. Then, in June 1913, Grand Vizier Mahmud Shevket was assassinated in broad daylight on the streets of Istanbul. The killing appears to have been a revenge attack carried out by a relative of the slain war minister Nazım Pasha. And if anything, the liberal opposition of the Freedom and Accord Party was more likely behind the plot than the CUP. But regardless of the intent, the consequences soon became clear. Shevket's death removed the last independent figure capable of restraining the Unionists. Talat immediately assumed the powerful post of Minister of the Interior, and the path to outright CUP rule now lay wide open. The assassination of General Mahmud Shevket was arguably even more consequential than the raid itself. For while Shevket had twice been elevated by the CUP themselves, first in 1909 after the Action Army marched on Istanbul, and now again in 1913, he had still never been entirely their man. He possessed his own power base within the military and enjoyed a reputation as a respected, somewhat nonpartisan general. Many believed he alone could preside over a unity government strong enough to navigate the empire through rebellion and war. With his assassination, that hope died, and in its place, the CUP grew bolder. When evidence began to surface that liberal deputies may have played a role in the plot, the Unionists seized the opportunity to take full control. Mehmet Talat was appointed Interior Minister on June the 12th, just one day after the assassination. And with that appointment, the CUP now installed one of its own at the heart of the empire's internal security machine. From this post, Talat directed a sweeping campaign of arrests, purges, and political intimidation. And though he did so as part of a broader Unionist takeover, alongside Enver Jemal and the other members of the CUP's Sacred Committee, the Interior Ministry under Talat now became the nerve center of the emergent one-party state. And so, the age of shadow governance was coming to an end, and the CUP was finally beginning to rule openly. Over the coming months, Talat and his allies increasingly ignored both Parliament and the Sultan. Even when ministers did consult the Chamber of Deputies, it was simply to rubber stamp their decrees as the body became dominated by Unionist loyalists. By early 1914, what had emerged was a one-party authoritarian regime, Talat acting as the administrative and political center of power, with Enver and Jemal serving as the public military faces of the new order. This was the essence of the so-called Three Pashas government. The end of the Second Balkan War in late 1913 would really bring this CUP dictatorship into unrivaled power. Now, the Balkan Wars as a whole had been an utter catastrophe. The Ottomans had lost almost all of their European territory, lands they had ruled for more than half a millennium, and Muslim refugees were now pouring into Istanbul, Edirne, Smyrna, and other cities throughout Anatolia in the thousands, all fleeing horrific atrocities carried out by the Balkan Christian armies. But the second phase of the conflict would end with what could be and was spun as a tiny glimmer of success. And for a public desperate for any good news at all, even this partial redemption would be enough to elevate the unionists now running the government. And at the center of this newfound prestige stood Ismail Enver. We ended last episode with the reversal of Bulgarian fortunes in 1913. And from the outset, Bulgaria had been the strongest member of the Balkan League and had done most of the fighting that shattered what remained of the Ottoman will to resist. Their greatest victories had come in Thrace, surrounding Edirne and pushing the Ottoman army back to the outskirts of Istanbul itself. But while the Bulgarians bled and struggled over in the east, their allies helped themselves to the real prizes: Macedonia, Kosovo, and Albania. The Greeks beat the Bulgarians to Salonika by a single day. The Serbs pushed into northern Macedonia and clashed repeatedly with Bulgarian forces even before the Second War officially began. In short, the Bulgarians did a lot of the heavy fighting while their allies seized the spoils of war. These simmering resentments would then explode by June 1913, when Bulgaria launched a disastrous attack on its former partners, who then immediately formed a new alliance against them. The Ottomans, sensing an opportunity in all this, quickly joined in. And now facing multiple fronts, the once victorious Bulgarian army fell back in complete disarray, and they were forced to essentially abandon Thrace, meaning that the siege of Edirne now suddenly collapsed. Enver would then seize the moment as he marched triumphantly into Edirne, virtually without firing a shot, and then claimed credit for the city's, quote, liberation. In truth, the victory had been won mainly due to the pressures applied by the other Balkan powers, but that hardly mattered. Enver understood the value of theatrics, and when he returned to Istanbul, he was hailed as, quote, the savior of Edirne, now a conquering hero whose daring confidence seemed to offer a new hope for national revival. The Treaty of Constantinople was signed on September the 29th, 1913, between the Ottoman Empire and Bulgaria. In that agreement, the cities of Edirne and Kirklareli in eastern Thrace were officially restored to Ottoman control, and the border demarcated at this treaty would lay the foundation for the modern frontier between Turkey and Bulgaria that still somewhat exists today. The psychological impact of the Balkan Wars, which had in less than a year whiplashed the Ottoman public from near total collapse to a burst of patriotic revival, was enormous. And for many, particularly those within the Unionist government, the lesson was simple. Only the military had been capable of salvaging Ottoman prestige and preserving even the rump territories that remained in the empire. So, with the recapture of Edirne, the national mythscape of a militarized Turkish renewal truly began to take root. Now, a belief in the army as the engine of national salvation had long been central to the CUP's worldview. And indeed, since 1908, they had relied repeatedly on military intervention to steer the state in their preferred direction. Three coups in less than 5 years had demonstrated their conviction that the army, not parliament, was the only reliable guardian of the nation. And now, as Muslim refugees were pouring into Anatolian cities, they brought with them stories of how their families had been driven from their homes by advancing Christian armies. So now, even for many ordinary Ottoman Muslims, their conclusion became the same as the hardcore Unionists, that survival itself now depended on military strength. As a result, young officers like Enver, Cemal, and eventually a rising commander named Mustafa Kemal would begin to step squarely into the spotlight of public life, no longer merely soldiers, but national saviors in waiting. This militarization of politics was hardly unique to the Ottomans. Their Balkan rivals had embraced it even earlier than them. Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece had spent decades cultivating radical officer corps committed to expansion at the Ottoman Empire's expense. The Balkan Wars were, in many ways, the inevitable climax of those long simmering nationalist irredentist ambitions within the Macedonian struggle. But it was only after 1913 that the Ottomans fully joined that game, now convinced that force, not diplomacy or reform, would have to define the future of their nation if they were going to survive. So, as the Second Balkan War came to a close, the CUP turned its full attention to modernizing the military in preparation for whatever came next. Enver would lead this effort. Appointed Minister of War in January 1914 and given the title of Pasha, he moved quickly to remake the army in his own image, promoting fellow Mektebli, or young academy-trained officers, into key posts while sidelining the older Ailila commanders who had risen through the ranks during the Hamidian era. And this was more than just a bureaucratic reshuffle. The Mektebli were reformist, technocratic, and increasingly aligned with an ideology now on the rise: Turkish nationalism. As we've discussed, the CUP's relationship with nationalism had always been complicated. The Revolution of 1908 had championed Ottomanism, a vision of constitutional pluralism in a multi-ethnic empire. Many of the early unionists were themselves Albanians, Jews, Kurds, Arabs, and even a few Balkan Christians. But after the Balkan Wars, after the loss of nearly all Christian-majority European territories, the Unionists drew a stark conclusion that if the empire was to survive, it would have to become Turkish. Enver, for his part, embraced a romantic form of pan-Turkism, envisioning Ottoman armies liberating the Turkic peoples across the Caucasus and Central Asia. Talat, meanwhile, was shaped by the ideas of Ziya Gurkayp, who advocated building a cohesive Turkish Islamic nation within the empire's surviving lands, particularly in Anatolia. Gurkayp's ideas would remain influential well beyond the Ottoman era, later reflected in Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's Republic. But in the immediate term, they mingled with a much darker impulse: the belief that non-Muslim populations were an obstacle to national unity. Armenians, Greeks, Assyrians, and Jews now faced a state that increasingly regarded them as foreign elements living on Turkish land. The situation was further inflamed after the Balkan Wars, as many Unionists blamed the empire's defeats on the supposed treachery of Christian communities. Now, to fully understand this turn, it is important to remember that the Balkan belligerents, Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece, had all once been Ottoman provinces. Ottoman elites still viewed their peoples as essentially rebellious subjects, and this suspicion extended to Christians who remained within Ottoman borders. So, immediately after the Second Balkan War, Greeks living in western Anatolia and southern Thrace faced discrimination, displacement, and outright violence. And even though there was no organized Armenian nation capable of waging any sort of war against the empire, Armenians were nonetheless grouped with other Christian populations and treated with similar hostility. The perpetrators of this repression came from all levels of society, but its institutional embodiment was the special organization, Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa, a covert paramilitary network born out of CUP conspiratorial cells in Salonika. Formed in 1913, it drew heavily from the veterans of the Macedonian struggle, men hardened by years of brutal warfare between Muslim and Christian guerrilla bands. Originally justified as the defenders of Muslims in hostile lands, particularly during the atrocities of the Balkan Wars, the organization's mission would invert once the European territories were lost, from protecting Muslims in Christian lands to cleansing Christians in Muslim lands. By 1914, with Enver controlling the war ministry and Talat the interior, the special organization came to operate as an unofficial arm of the state, a deniable instrument for surveillance, intimidation, expulsion, and eventually mass violence. The most horrific expression of these policies would come during the First World War and its aftermath, a chain of catastrophes from 1915 into the early 1920s, culminating in the Armenian, Greek, and Assyrian genocides. Yet, even before the war began, the ideological architecture and institutional machinery that enabled those crimes were already largely in place. This exclusive vision of Turkish nationalism would devastate Christian communities most catastrophically, but it also transformed relations with non-Turkish Muslims.
Kurds in eastern Anatolia, and Arabs in Syria and Palestine increasingly found themselves marginalized within the CUP's centralized Turkish Islamic State. As the CUP tightened control over provincial administration, education, and the press, resentment spread. Many Kurds and Arabs began turning toward nationalist movements of their own. And during the Great War, these frustrations would erupt into outright rebellion. And following the old Balkan playbook, some non-Turkish Muslim leaders aligned with rival great powers. Kurdish factions with Russia, and Arab leaders most famously with Great Britain, each hoping foreign backing might secure the autonomy the CUP refused to grant. But the ongoing denial of Kurdish statehood and the adventures of old Lawrence of Arabia are stories for another day. For the rest of today's episode, I want to zoom in on the events of 1914, leading up to and following the July Crisis and the subsequent outbreak of World War I. The Ottoman Empire would be the last of the great powers to join the conflict, and a closer look at Ottoman diplomacy and internal politics is required to understand two key questions. First, why did the Ottomans join a great power conflict just after suffering their greatest military defeat since the empire's founding? And second, how did they end up siding with the Central Powers? By January 1914, the triumvirate, commonly known as the Three Pashas, was ruling openly. Initially, only Talat held a government portfolio after the assassination of Mahmud Shevket in June 1913. But then Talat used his political charisma and rising influence within the CUP to place hardcore unionists from the Sacred Committee into key government posts. This maneuvering would culminate in Enver's appointment as Minister of War in January 1914, a controversial choice given that he was only 33 years old. At the same time, Talat also helped orchestrate the elevation of Ahmed Cemal, previously military governor of Istanbul, to the post of Minister of the Navy. Finally, Talat also brought his longtime comrade from Salonika, the Donme economist Mehmet Javid, as Minister of Finance in early 1914. And so by January the 8th, a diplomat familiar with Istanbul politics would remark, quote, "We are in fact governed by a triumvirate, Talat, Enver, and Cemal Bey, all men of authority who one feels capable of rash and violent action." This observation is sometimes cited as the origin of the Three Pashas label used to describe the CUP dictatorship during World War I. But even though Talat, Enver, and Cemal were clearly the three most powerful figures in early 1914, the political landscape in Istanbul would continue to shift in the years ahead. And from the start, it was Talat who proved to be the dominant force in Ottoman politics. As Talat's biographer Hans Lucas Kaiser writes, quote, "By spring 1914, for any serious observer of Ottoman affairs, Talat was the first political figure in the capital. And although a minister of the interior, he also actively led in diplomacy." So, even though the young military officers Enver and Cemal were perhaps the most visible faces of change, it was Talat who was often pulling the strings from behind the curtain. Moving into 1914, the major preoccupation of this new government was twofold. First, to prevent a repeat of the disaster of the Balkan Wars, and second, if possible, to reclaim some of the empire's lost territories. And it was now clear that achieving both of these aims would require something the Ottomans currently lacked, a strong great power ally. And after many diplomatic twists and turns, that ally would turn out to be Germany. The alliance between the Ottoman and German empires had deep roots. As we noted when we introduced General Mahmud Shevket, German military officers had long been central to Ottoman military reform. An entire generation of Ottoman officers earned the nickname the Goltz Generation, after the Prussian Field Marshal Kolmar von der Goltz. And in 1914, yet another German military mission would be sent to the Ottoman Empire to help them reform their military. And this mission would be led by General Otto Liemann von Sanders. Arriving in December 1913, von Sanders would prove to be the last of these German officers sent to reorganize the Ottoman military. And his appointment quickly sparked a diplomatic crisis as Russia openly protested growing German influence in Istanbul. Russia's complaint reflected more than just old animosity toward the Ottomans or their emergent rivalry with Germany. It stemmed from a broader geopolitical ambition, because at that same moment, the Russians were secretly drawing up plans to occupy Istanbul, should another crisis weaken the Ottoman state. And so, the Ottoman Empire, already exposed by the Balkan defeats, now found itself under greater pressure than ever before from Russia. Within the framework of the great power alliances, this Russian hostility mattered enormously, because it isolated the Ottomans from Russia's Entente partners, Great Britain and France, who had once been their most dependable allies. Historically, the Ottomans' survival often hinged on Anglo-French support against Russia. They triumphed in the Crimean War precisely because of that alliance, but suffered crushing defeats in the Russo-Turkish Wars of 1828 and 1877, when Britain and France stood aside. Britain especially had long viewed the Ottoman Empire as a useful buffer against Russian expansion in the so-called Great Game. But one of the most consequential diplomatic shifts before 1914 was Britain's rapprochement with Russia. The 1907 Anglo-Russian Convention had actually originated from the effort to outmaneuver the Germans in the Ottoman Empire. Since 1903, the Germans had been working with the Ottomans to build a railway from Baghdad to Berlin. Now, this railroad would never be completed, but still, it was viewed as a common threat by both the British and the Russians. And so it was this squabble over influence in the Ottoman Balkans that initiated this 1907 Anglo-Russian Convention that would effectively end the Great Game. But what it meant for the Ottomans was that their traditional patrons, Great Britain, were now working with their arch nemesis, Russia. So this new Entente alliance not only further deepened German and Austrian paranoia, but it also pushed the Ottomans ever closer to Germany. But even so, the Ottoman-German alliance unfolded in fits and starts, and in many ways the Young Turks would revert to the classic strategy of the Tanzimat and Hamidian eras, of playing one great power against another. Because while Lehman von Sanders was reforming their army under German auspices, Finance Minister Javid was negotiating a major loan with France, and Jemal was in talks with Britain over the purchase of new warships. Then in May 1914, on the very eve of the July crisis, Talat made a visit to the Crimea to meet Tsar Nicholas II, ostensibly to discuss administrative reforms in the Armenian provinces of eastern Anatolia. But this was not a remorseful act of apology, but more a gesture of conciliatory realism, a diplomatic outreach born of necessity. For Talat understood that the empire's survival now depended on being accepted within the European order. He would tell a journalist during these talks with Russia that his greatest desire was, quote, to enter the family of Europe. Because belonging to Europe, he explained, quote, would assure us the entrance into the European state's rule of law. Presently, if there is something like a rule of law, it is only for Europeans. We Ottomans, like Asians, Africans, and Australians, are anyway people outside of and alien to Europe. The main principles of the rule of law are not acknowledged as valid for us. See the annoyance. Wherever we turn and apply, nobody turns his face to us. And so, in the Unionist diplomacy of 1914, we see a dangerous game emerging on an unequal playing field, a crumbling empire seeking legitimacy in a European system that had already decided long ago that it would never belong. For the Ottoman leadership, the backdrop to all of these diplomatic maneuvers, the search for a great power ally, the delicate balancing acts with Russia, Britain, France, and Germany, was a rapidly escalating confrontation much closer to home, the growing tension with Greece. During the Balkan Wars, Greece had seized southern Macedonia and its capital, Salonika, the birthplace of the Committee of Union and Progress, and the home of many of its most important leaders. At sea, the Greek navy had also captured several Aegean islands that had long been under Ottoman control, many of them lying just off the western Anatolian coast. After the war, the question of sovereignty over these islands was left unresolved by the great powers, kicked down the road as so many things were, and perhaps predictably, the issue then became a flashpoint. For the CUP leadership, the Greek occupation of these islands was more than just another humiliation, it was an existential threat. The islands of Lesbos, Chios, Limnos, and Samos all sat within artillery range of key Ottoman coastal cities like Smyrna, aka Izmir. So the retaking of these islands became a national security priority by early 1914. To address this imbalance in the Aegean, naval minister Jemal began negotiating with both the British and the Germans to secure new battleships for the Ottoman Navy. And so a miniature dreadnought race, running parallel to the Anglo-German one playing out in the North Sea, had now opened up in the Aegean. At the same time, reports poured into Athens and Istanbul of atrocities and reprisals, attacks on Muslims in Greek-held Macedonia, and on Orthodox Christians in western Anatolia. So by spring, tensions were spiraling dangerously close to open war. The crisis peaked in May 1914 when the great powers stepped in to mediate. The resulting London Protocol confirmed Greek control over most of the Aegean islands, but at least returned the two islands guarding the entrance to the Turkish Straits at the Dardanelles, Imbros and Tenedos, to Ottoman sovereignty. It was a compromise, but one that, per usual, satisfied exactly no one. Now, just a few weeks later, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo would completely overshadow this little Aegean crisis. But for the Ottomans, the episode left two lasting consequences. First, it deepened their sense of humiliation. Once again, the great powers had sided with Greece, reinforcing the Union's conviction that Britain and Russia were both pro-Greek and irredeemably anti-Turk. Second, it accelerated the Ottoman naval buildup. The three pashas pushed forward the construction of two massive dreadnoughts being built in British shipyards, the Reshadiya and the Sultan Osman I. These ships were paid for through Ottoman public subscriptions and thus were seen as symbols of renewed national pride. By mid-1914, the mood in Istanbul was one of encirclement. The empire seemed surrounded by hostile Christian powers on every side. And so the logic that had guided the CUP since 1908 just hardened even further. If the Ottoman Empire was going to survive, it would have to rely on its own strength of arms. On June the 28th, 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austrian throne, was assassinated in the streets of Sarajevo by the 19-year-old Gavrilo Princip. Now, we are going to dive headlong into the swirl of conspiracy, nationalism, and revolutionary politics that drove this assassination in our ISM bonus episode on Sarajevo, 1914. But here, I want to step back and think about the larger meaning of this moment within the long history of the Ottoman Empire and its collapse. Because within our story, Sarajevo was not just any old city. Sarajevo was the capital of the Austrian province of Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Bosnia had been an Ottoman province for nearly 500 years. And though Austria-Hungary had occupied the territory in 1878, they had only formally annexed it 6 years earlier, in 1908, the event that sparked the Bosnian crisis. And that annexation was itself a direct consequence of the Young Turk Revolution. When the CUP rose up in Ottoman Macedonia in 1908 and re-established the constitution, the Balkan balance of power had been disrupted. So Bulgaria seized the moment and declared their independence, and then Austria seized the moment and swallowed up Bosnia. Both moves were driven, in part, by fear that a newly reformed and self-confident Ottoman Empire might return to the Balkans and reassert control. So now, in the summer of 1914, 6 years later, the tensions unleashed in the Balkans by the Young Turk Revolution had come full circle. A radical Serb assassinated an Austrian archduke in a city that had been Ottoman until basically yesterday, at least in historical time. The Great War that followed was, of course, driven by much larger alliance systems. But the spark itself, the assassination that set those alliances in motion, cannot be separated from the long durée of the Ottoman collapse. And so, as the July crisis unfolded, the Ottoman Empire, bruised, isolated, and desperate for protection, now had to decide which great power could guarantee its survival in a dangerous bipolar world. A world now armed to the teeth and marching toward catastrophe.
Amidst the July crisis, as Vienna issued its ultimatum to Belgrade, as Russia mobilized, and as Germany issued the infamous blank check, the three pashas began a careful diplomatic game of cat and mouse. Once it became clear in the final days of July that a general European war was almost certain, the Ottoman Empire suddenly became a critically important question. For Russia, the war presented an opportunity. Ever since the Balkan Wars, the Ottomans had closed the Turkish Straits to foreign warships, preventing the Russian Black Sea Fleet from accessing the Mediterranean. Many in St. Petersburg believed that any future Russian victory must begin with the occupation of Istanbul and the seizure of the straits. For Germany, the calculation ran in the opposite direction. Now encircled by France in the west and Russia in the east, Berlin would increasingly need the Ottomans, both to open a southern front against Russia and to keep the British and French fleets tied down in the Mediterranean. Amidst the confusion of July, War Minister Enver privately assured the German ambassador Wangenheim that he favored a German alliance, but only if Germany guaranteed the empire's territorial integrity and offered substantial financial and military support. Talat likewise played his own game as he continued peace feelers with Russia while simultaneously presenting Berlin with draft alliance terms. And then finally, all the while, Jamal was busy trying but ultimately failing to form an alliance with the French. And so, in the final week of July, the Ottomans appeared both neutral and available, and therefore worth bidding for. But then, on August the 2nd, the balancing act would come to an end. Under intense pressure from Enver, the CUP cabinet signed a secret treaty of alliance with Germany. The agreement committed the Ottomans to join the war once Germany had won decisive victories in Europe. Publicly, however, the Ottomans continued to declare their neutrality. So, in early August 1914, the Ottoman Empire was in a strange position of being secretly allied with Germany while simultaneously posing as a neutral power, still bargaining for more naval support, still waiting for the right moment to act, and still convinced that they could choose the perfect moment to enter the war on their own terms. In the middle of this strategic balancing act, two dramatic events would eventually tip the scales. First, in early August 1914, Great Britain seized the two Ottoman dreadnoughts then nearing completion in British shipyards, the Reshadiya and the Sultan Osman I. These two ships had been funded almost entirely through Ottoman public subscription. So, ordinary Ottomans, merchants, school children, farmers, widows, had donated jewelry, savings, wages, and livestock to build them. And now, on the eve of war, the British simply confiscated them. The outrage in Istanbul was volcanic, and public opinion swung violently against Great Britain overnight. Then, on August the 10th, two German warships, the Goeben and the Breslau, arrived unexpectedly at the Dardanelles after a week-long chase across the Mediterranean as they were pursued by British and French squadrons. These ships were not sent as a gift. They were fleeing for their lives, but when they reached the Dardanelles, the Ottomans faced a choice. Either they could turn them away and risk a diplomatic rupture with Germany, or let them in and risk war with Britain and France. And well, they would decide to let them in. These ships were then quote-unquote sold to the Ottoman Navy and reflagged as Ottoman vessels, with German crews now wearing fezes and nominally under Ottoman command. So, overnight, the Ottoman fleet became a force to be reckoned with in the Eastern Mediterranean. What this meant is that in the very, very early days of the war, Germany had both outflanked Britain and France and had now given the Ottomans, their secret ally, the naval capacity they had long dreamed of. For a few weeks, the Ottomans tried to maintain the fiction of neutrality. But then, in early September, the First Battle of the Marne shattered German hopes of a quick victory in the west. The Schlieffen Plan had failed, the war was now clearly going to be long and brutal, and Germany could no longer afford to carry a passive Ottoman ally. Berlin now actually needed Istanbul in the war as soon as possible. But still, throughout September and into October, the Ottomans continued to insist they were neutral. Talat and Javed still hoped to extract more loans from the Germans.
Jamal still floated diplomatic feelers to the British, and Enver still played his double game inside the War Ministry. But the presence of the Gurbin, now renamed the Yavuz Sultan Selim, had fundamentally changed the situation. The most powerful ship in the Ottoman fleet was, in reality, commanded by a German admiral, Wilhelm Souchon. And Souchon had clear instructions from Berlin that he was now to force the Ottoman Empire into the war. And at the head of the Ottoman government, Souchon would find a willing collaborator. 32-year-old war minister Ismail Enver had come to believe that Germany would inevitably win the war, and that the future of the empire and his own future career now depended on joining the war early, not late. The other ministers remained cautious, but Enver, controlling the war ministry and now loyal to the German mission, had the power to bypass them. So, on October the 29th, 1914, without informing most of the cabinet, the Ottoman fleet, led by German Admiral Souchon, launched a surprise attack on Russian naval bases in the Black Sea. They bombarded Sevastopol, Odessa, and Theodosia. Enver then deliberately delayed attempts by anti-war ministers to send an apology to St. Petersburg for this Black Sea raid. And so the Russians responded by declaring war on the Ottomans on November the 1st. Britain and France would declare war just a few days later. So just like that, the 600-year-old Ottoman Empire had entered the First World War. In many ways, Enver's high-handed diplomacy in the lead-up to the Black Sea raid and the eventual Ottoman entry into the war was the final decisive turning point in the long collapse of the empire. For it was here that the ambition and overconfidence of the Young Turk leadership finally collided with geopolitical reality. They believed they could control the tempo of events, but they would instead lock the empire into a brutal life-or-death world war that it was simply not prepared to fight. For the leaders of the CUP, power, modernization, and national salvation had always been synonymous. And by 1914, they had fully convinced themselves that only force could rescue what remained of the Ottoman world. Whether the empire would have collapsed regardless of their entry into the Great War is a question for historical hypotheticals. Because what matters is that they did join. Enver had staked the survival of the empire on the gamble that Germany would win. And once Germany did not win, everything would come crashing down. The full story of the Ottomans in the Great War lies beyond the scope of this second season. And so this is where we will leave things for now. The three pashas are securely in power, Talat acting as the de facto dictator at home, Enver launching the empire into a world war to the death, and Jamal doing his best to keep up. But before we end today, I want to return briefly to a question we first posed in episode 2 of this season. Who were the Young Turks, and what did their revolution ultimately mean? And after 30-plus episodes, this question is still somewhat elusive, but I do believe we now have a working answer. The Young Turks had begun as reformers, people like Ahmed Reza, Prince Sabahaddin, Ismail Kemal, who hoped to drag the Ottoman Empire into the modern age. Exile then placed them all in Paris, briefly aligned their interests, and turned them into a formidable opposition to Sultan Abdulhamid. Then, years of continued crisis, territorial losses, and great power manipulations radicalized a new generation and infused the reformist language of the late Tanzimat era with a new belief in the power of militarized national unity. The revolution of 1908 had been fought in the name of the Constitution, but the party who secured its victory, the CUP's Sacred Committee in Salonika, had always been filled with conspiratorial individuals like Talat, Enver, and Jamal, who saw themselves immersed in a Darwinian struggle for national survival. This vision had been forged in the brutal realities of the Macedonian struggle, the defining conflict early on for many of the most important young officers of the CUP. And in a world where the wolves of European imperialism and the jackals of Balkan irredentism were always hungrily eyeing their lands and their people, war abroad and absolute obedience at home came to be seen as the only viable options. So what began as an experiment in constitutional government and plural democracy ended in authoritarian dictatorship and exclusive Islamic Turkish nationalism. By fall 1914, the world was descending into chaos, and the Ottomans would, in the end, be engulfed in this vortex. But before we go on hiatus, we still have one more episode to go. Sarajevo 1914 will be dropping soon, and when it does, that means that the first three episodes of Ism will also be out. So there is a whole lot to look forward to, and I am so excited to have you come along with me as we continue our journey together. So next time, I will see you in Sarajevo for The Assassin, The Archduke, and Nationalism's Crucible.